Okay, so this is bio 231. And let's see. Posted everybody's scores up on Blackboard so you can see what the whole class is doing. And it's the same as that sheet of paper right over there. The last four columns tell you what you need to do on the last test to get an A, B, C, or whatever in the class. So you kind of know exactly where you stand. And the last test. Make sure you copy this down right. Double check, make sure I got it right. Because it'd be a shame if you were to show up at one time and I was to show up at a different time. December 15th. All right, exam 5 at 10:30. And it's going to be in this room, 10:30 to 12:30. And that is that a Monday? Yeah, that's Monday on the 15th. So December 15th at 10:30. So that's interesting. That's the same time as, yeah. You know what? It includes the last practicum and the lecture final, but it doesn't. If you have any quizzes remaining, your remaining quizzes will influence your grade a little bit, but not in a major way. But the practicum will. Okay. And I think also if you get to take another quiz, I think maybe your lab instructor might even drop the lowest one. So again, I really don't know what the schedule for the quizzes is. Yeah, so there are 50 points left for the practicum and, 210 points left for the last test? Okay, so remember you multiply the percentage by 210 points to figure out how many points you get for a particular test. Add them all up together, okay? All right, so December 15th, 10:30 in this room. All right, so let's finish circulatory system really quick. So this is sort of what you had on your last test. What's that? That's the heart. Okay. And what kind of vessel is this? What kind of blood vessel is that? That's an artery. Yeah, that's taking blood away from the heart. All right, that probably was a question on the test. Here is another vessel. What's that? That's a vein. And in the usual kind of circulatory system, where does exchange take place? In the capillary. Oh, I forgot that on the diagram here. Could there be exchange taking place on the structures that I put on the board so far? No. We got the heart, we got an artery, we got a vein. Why can't exchange take place in these structures? They're too thick. The walls are way too thick. Okay? So exchange can only take place in what kind of vessel? A capillary. That's right. Thanks for reminding me. So I'm going to diagram a capillary as like this little network of blood vessels right here. All right, these are very thin-walled blood vessels, so things can diffuse in and out of capillaries. And don't forget, some capillaries are really leaky. Some are even exceptionally leaky. So different kinds of capillaries allow for more or less exchange as well. What are the kinds of capillaries? Sinusoidal-type capillaries, that's one. Continuous is another. That's the least leaky. And fenestrated. That's like the middle kind. All right, so and then capillaries are hooked up to these, arteries and veins. And you know of two circulations like this in the body. What are the two major circulations that follow this scheme? Yeah, systemic and pulmonary circulations. So a good question would be, how many capillary beds are usually between an artery and a vein? And it's a really simple answer. You're just going to say, well, there's usually only one capillary bed. Okay? But there are a couple special circulations in the body where we don't find one capillary bed between the artery and a vein coming from and going back to the heart. Okay? So this is the usual kind of circulatory system, but there are a couple places that look like this. You have the artery, and you have one capillary bed over here connected by a vessel going to a second capillary bed right here before it goes back to the heart. So this is capillary bed number one. Here is capillary bed number two. And can you see that there's an inherent difference right here? There's two capillary beds in series or back to back. So what this is Right, so can exchange take place in this capillary? Absolutely. Can exchange take place in this capillary? Yeah, absolutely. So what this system is a special delivery system. All right, so it's a door-to-door delivery system where maybe compound A gets absorbed by capillary bed 1 and it's delivered to capillary bed 2 and it diffuses out. So A can't diffuse in this direction because it's way too far. Right, this distance is way too far apart, but compounds can enter the circulatory system in capillary bed 1 and they can leave capillary bed 2, and what that allows is that this compound A doesn't have to enter the whole circulation. So maybe these are some special signaling molecules that are going to signal this tissue to do something. In the case, this would be a hormone. Right? But in the case that we have on the board, right, these compounds right here are toxins that are absorbed by your body. And these toxins you don't want floating around going to your brain and all over everywhere else. They need to be detoxified. So where do we normally pick up toxins? Digestive tract. All right, we just eat them with our food and things that we drink. Like name your favorite liquid compound that's very toxic. Yeah, ethyl alcohol, for instance. Okay, so, but in all foods that we eat, there are toxins, there are chemicals in those food items, all right, and we don't want that just going into our normal circulation. They go over here first to be detoxified. And what organ system is this by capillary bed number 2? We haven't talked about it yet, but this would be, for instance, the liver. Is one of the functions of the liver is to detoxify compounds. All right, so those toxins never enter your whole circulatory system, never get to your brain to produce damage. So this right here is not an artery, not really a vein. It's got a special name. So the vessel between two capillary beds is called a portal vessel. Portal. And you could, sometimes it's called a portal vein. Right, that just connects two capillary beds before going back to the heart. Need my mouse. Okay. And so in particular, since that's going to the liver, we call that the hepatic portal system. Right? Because anytime you hear hepato, you should think of liver. Just like when you hear osteo, what should you think of?
Bone,
yeah. Okay. All right, so it's just a special delivery system. So there are a couple places that have this portal system. The first one is the hepatic portal system. The second one is in the nephron. Anybody have an idea where the nephron is? Yeah, it's in your kidneys. We're going to look at that, probably not today, but maybe next time. The nephron has a portal system. A third place would be the hypothalamic hypophyseal portal system. This is a special portal system between the hypothalamus. Where's the hypothalamus at? It's in your brain, right? It's underneath the thalamus. And the hypophysis, anybody know what the there's no reason on earth why anybody in here would know what the hypophysis is, but you will know it as soon as I tell you. Hypophysis is just a scientific name for the pituitary gland. So somebody decided to make it simpler, and so instead of calling it pituitary, they call it the hypophysis, right? That means below the hypothalamus is what that means. So there's a special portal system between the hypothalamus, which takes minute quantities of hormones directly to the anterior pituitary, where those hormones have an effect on numerous systems in your body. Okay. So maybe you should know these three right now, but the one that you should be most familiar with is the hepatic portal system. So let's trace that out real quick. All right, so capillary bed 1 is in the gastrointestinal tract. For instance, around the stomach and the intestines. And so blood coming back from the digestive tract is collected by the gastric vein. Where is this coming back from? The stomach, right? The superior mesenteric vein, the inferior mesenteric vein, and the splenic vein, right? All go into the hepatic portal vein. You probably run into that in lab. I don't know if you talked about why it's there. But the hepatic portal vein doesn't empty into the vena cava going back to the heart. It takes the blood to the liver where there's a second capillary bed. And there are special sinusoidal capillaries in the liver, so they're very leaky. So blood leaks out of the vascular system. It flows through the liver. And the compounds in blood are detoxified, and then the liver collects the blood, puts it back into a vein. And what's the name of that vein coming from the liver? That's the hepatic vein. And the hepatic vein empties into the inferior vena cava, and that takes it back to the right atrium. Okay, so that's the hepatic portal circulation. Okay. Oh, we got to review fetal circulation. Okay, I forgot about that. Let's see if I can find a diagram of that. Well, there's five structures that you have to be aware of in terms of the fetal circulation. So I think this is kind of a review for lab. But so a what's a fetus?
Baby.
A baby. What kind of baby? Unborn baby. Yeah, it's a baby before being born, right? All right, so what organ system is a fetus not using?
Lungs,
because they can't breathe air, right? Because they're in utero. They just have amniotic fluid. Well, they try to breathe amniotic fluid, but it really doesn't do them much good. All right, so they need another organ to take the place of the lungs and, to a large degree, the liver as well. Okay, so the fetus is not really using their liver and their lungs, but the fetus still needs oxygen, right? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So when you think, and the organ that provides that function for the fetus is the placenta. Okay, so the placenta is acting like the lungs. And the placenta is really kind of interesting tissue because it's not strictly fetal tissue and it's not strictly maternal tissue. It's actually an organ that's composed of two different individuals. And that's, I don't know, I kind of find that fascinating, because what would happen if you had tissue from another individual growing inside you? What would happen to it? It would be rejected. Okay, and I'm not sure we know why that this placenta isn't rejected by the mother and why the placenta isn't rejected by the fetus, since it's a combination of all these things. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure anybody really knows why fetus isn't rejected by the mother's physiology yet. So that's all kind of interesting stuff. But nonetheless, the placenta is taking the place of the lungs. So in terms of the regular circulatory system, give me the name of a blood vessel in an adult that carries, not a blood vessel, how about a vein that carries oxygenated blood? The pulmonary vein. And what blood vessel, no, what artery carries deoxygenated blood? The pulmonary artery. So the pulmonary circulation is backwards compared to the systemic circulation in the adult in terms of what kind of gases it's carrying. All right, so you should see that same kind of analogy for the fetal circulation in blood vessels going to the placenta, because the placenta is acting kind of like the pulmonary circulation. All right, so here we have two diagrams, two illustrations, and this is the fetal circulation, here is the adult circulation. And so there are capillaries in the placenta where exchange takes place. So in the lungs, which way is oxygen going? Which way is oxygen going in the lungs? In the body or out? It's going in the body, right? All right, so the placenta is exactly the same thing. So blood going to the placenta is losing carbon dioxide and picking up oxygen, just like the lungs. So the blood going to, so here we have these arrows showing blood going to the placenta. These are arteries or veins? These are arteries, right? Because the heart is pumping blood to the placenta, just like the pulmonary trunk is an artery. This is deoxygenated blood going to the placenta, and these are the umbilical arteries, even though it's deoxygenated. And the umbilical vein coming back, we can see, is what? Oxygenated or deoxygenated? It's oxygenated. If you look at the, if you can see those colors right there, right? So this blood is nice and red. It's oxygenated, just like the pulmonary veins, just like the pulmonary veins are. Okay, so that's what I want you to see about the umbilical arteries and the umbilical vein. The arteries are relatively deoxygenated, but the vein is oxygenated. All right, so also the fetus is really not using the liver. Where, how is the detoxification function of the fetus being accomplished primarily? By the mother's liver, right? So blood doesn't really have to go to the liver, so It bypasses the liver, so instead of going into the, for instance, like the hepatic portal vein, which normally takes blood for detoxification to the liver, it bypasses the liver and goes directly into the, what does this look like? See, this is going up to the heart, right here, to the right atrium. This is the inferior vena cava. Okay, so the ductus venosus is that special little shunt that takes blood from the umbilical vein directly to the inferior vena cava to join the fetal circulation. Okay, so those are three things that are different so far in the fetus: umbilical arteries, umbilical vein, and the ductus venosus. Okay, now let's consider two other things. Okay, so we said that blood doesn't have to go to the lungs because it's already oxygenated. So there is a shunt placed between the right atrium and the left atrium. Okay, and so that's the foramen ovale. So again, that's going to bypass blood necessarily having to be pumped through the lungs. This is going to go directly to the systemic circulation because it's oxygenated already. All right, right through here. See that little foramen ovale right there? All right, and then, for instance, some blood does go through the right atrium into the right ventricle, pump through the pulmonary trunk up over here, but here is another escape route so that the heart doesn't have to expend a lot of energy pumping blood to the lungs because it doesn't have to go there. Here is another little shunt. This is called the ductus arteriosus. All right, so this takes blood from the pulmonary trunk to the aorta. And we had some pretty good models in lab where you could see these things. All right, so those are the five structures that are special in the fetal circulation. But of course, they should disappear when somebody's born, right? Because when somebody's born, do they have a placenta anymore? Non-functional, and they're going to die unless what systems take over? Okay, well, their lungs have to take over for the placenta as well as the liver. All right, and if they're going to take over, then they need to have blood going to them. All right, so, all right, well, we just tie the umbilicus off, all right, but the internal parts, right, the umbilical arteries turn into the medial umbilical ligaments. All right, so probably you should make a couple columns on your piece of paper. The first column, why don't you put umbilical arteries, umbilical vein, okay, ductus venosus, this is all in the first column, foramen ovale, and ductus arteriosus. So this kind of sounds like Harry Potter novel, but it's okay. All right, so umbilical artery, umbilical vein, ductus venosus, foramen ovale, and ductus arteriosus. And then in the right-hand column, let's write down what these structures turn into in the adult. Okay, when the newborn babies, right, when the neonates, lungs take over and liver takes over. Well, the umbilical arteries turn into the medial umbilical ligaments. And the umbilical vein turns into the ligamentum teres. So we see the ligamentum teres right here going through the liver. All right, the ductus venosus turns into ligamentum venosum. And the foramen ovale turns into a depression in the interatrial septum, which we call the fossa ovalis. Most of the heart models, you can see it pretty clearly, but even though you can't see it, if you palpate with your fingertips in the models, you can find that depression. All right, that's the foramen ovale. And the ductus arteriosus turns into the ligamentum arteriosum right here. And that was usually painted kind of white on the models. All right, the connection between the pulmonary and the aorta, pulmonary artery and the aorta. Unfortunately, most of the specimens of living heart tissue that we had, most of the great vessels were chopped off the heart. So you couldn't see that ligamentum arteriosum, but it's really obvious to see if someone hadn't chopped those off the base of the heart. All right, so that's the fetal circulation. So when you think of fetal circulation, where should you start thinking? Automatically think that the placenta is taking the place of the lungs, and then think of the pulmonary circulation, and kind of build your picture of what the fetal circulation is doing and what it looks like, okay, starting at that level. Okay. Okay. All right, so any of those questions, I suppose, could be on the test. Like, what does the foramen ovale turn into? The fossovallus, yeah. So just make sure you can interconvert both of those. And make sure you can tell me what job the placenta is doing. It's doing the job of the lungs. Right, okay. So that might seem a little backwards when you first think of it, but just always think of it in terms of the pulmonary circulation, and you should be pretty familiar with that. Okay, so does anybody have any questions on that or a portal circulation? No? Okay. All right, well, let me see if I can find what we want to talk about today. And what is that we want to talk about? Lymphatic system. Okay. That's chapter 20. Oops. Maybe I'll close that down. All right, so the lymphatic system. Some of you sort of might be familiar with the lymphatic system, but we're going to cover it in a little bit of detail here. Maybe you think about it a little bit differently than how you've usually thought about it. Well, first, let's define what makes up the lymphatic system before we talk about what its function is. All right, there's a fluid that is found in the lymphatic system, and that fluid we call lymph. We're going to talk about where that stuff comes from in just a second. Then there are cells that can be found in the lymphatic system. These are lymphocytes. And lymphocyte is a kind of white blood cell. We didn't talk much about blood in here, I don't think. But blood has got a number of different kinds of cells. Blood has... I'll just kind of... So whole blood, what's whole blood? That's everything that's in blood. So if we were to take some blood out of somebody, it would be whole blood. All right, so whole blood has got two major components to it. It's got plasma, and it's got something we call formed elements. Formed elements. And plasma is the fluid part of blood. And formed elements is the cellular part. That's the cellular part. So plasma, it's got fluid. What do you think the major component of the fluid is in blood? Most of it. It's actually the most common chemical in your body. It's water. Yeah. So for instance, water makes up plasma. Then there are some proteins that make up plasma. Okay, and nutrients like glucose and things like that, various ions are dissolved in plasma. Don't want to spend too much time on that. But formed elements, the cellular part. Can anybody tell me what kind of cells you would see in blood? Sure, because you had a practicum on this. Red blood cells. All right, so let's call a red blood cell an erythrocyte. What does erythro mean? It means red. Okay. Another kind of formed element is a leukocyte. Yeah, and leuko means white. That's a white blood cell. Okay. Leukocyte is a white blood cell. And then the last kind over here is what we call a thrombocyte. Okay. Thrombocyte, that is the same thing as a platelet. All right, so the number of functions of blood is to carry oxygen. Which one of these cells carries oxygen? Erythrocytes carry oxygen. All right, so I'm going to just kind of put O2 right over here. There's a cell that fights infections. White blood cells. Okay. So I'm just going to say immunity here for leukocytes. And thrombocytes, another important function of blood. Oh, what kind of tissue is blood?
Living.
It's living tissue. I like it. It's alive. Okay, but what's another kind? It's a connective tissue. Yeah, it's a connective tissue. But it's a kind of funny connective tissue because it's a fluid connective tissue. So it flows. So if you ever put a hole in a blood vessel, what's going to happen to blood? It's just going to flow right out of your body. But you need blood, right? So another important function of blood is to stop blood loss when a blood vessel gets damaged. And so that's the job of a thrombocyte. And that we call, okay, hemostasis. That's what we call hemostasis, preventing blood loss. And in a physiology class, we would talk about how your body actually performs hemostasis. All right, but what I'm trying to get at right here, leukocyte. There are a number of different kinds of leukocytes. And there are five important kinds. There's the most common is neutrophil. What's the job of a neutrophil? Fight infection. Okay. Lymphocyte. What's the job of a lymphocyte? Fight infection. That's right. It's going to fight infection. All right. Monocyte. What's the job of a monocyte? Fight infection. Okay. Then there's a couple more. I'm never going to test you on these things. But I'm just going to put it down so that you see where all these things fit into. Okay. And an eosinophil and a basophil. All right. But when we're talking about the lymphatic system, okay, we're going to talk about two, because part of the job of the lymphatic system is to fight infection. So you would guess it's going to require some leukocytes to do that. Okay. One of the most important is the lymphocyte. And you can tell this is part of the lymphatic system because why? Here we see lympho, right in the name of that cell. Okay? And then a monocyte also is important for helping fight infection in terms of the lymphatic system. But so I wanted you to know where lymphocyte fit in. It's a blood cell, but it's a white blood cell that fights infection. Alright, so lymphocytes are important in the lymphatic system. There are lymph vessels. Guess what the job of a lymph vessel is? It's to carry lymph around. And one of the ways it helps our bodies to fight infection. All right. And then there are some organs of the lymphatic system, like, for instance, lymph nodes. Lymph nodes filter lymph. They contain lymphocytes as well. And they contain a derivative of a monocyte. But these help fight infection that is found in lymph. Tonsils are similar to lymph nodes. They fight infections from bacteria, for instance, or viruses that are trying to get inside your body through what kind of orifices? Like through your mouth and your nose, right? Because that's open to the outside world all the time. And the spleen is a lymphatic organ. That doesn't filter lymph, but it filters blood. So if there are pathogens that get in your blood, it's the part of the job of the spleen is to identify those pathogens and figure out a way how to kill them. And the thymus gland is in your mediastinum, and that's a special place where a certain kind of lymphocyte goes to mature so it knows how to fight infections. Okay, so your thymus gland is in your mediastinum. All right, so those are the components. So here is not a picture of the lymphatic system. Do I have a picture? Yeah, here's kind of an overview of the lymphatic system. Here are lymph vessels that we can see in somebody's arm. And the thymus gland, would be about in this region right here. I don't see it. But here's the spleen, for instance. Tonsils, I don't see. I think I have some other pictures a little bit later on. All right, well, let me carry on with the functions. Okay, lymphatic system maintains fluid balance. So in a capillary every day, in all the capillaries of your body, about 30 liters of fluid leaks out of a capillary every day. So how much is like a huge Coke bottle? That's like 2 liters. So like 10 of those leak out, more than 10 of those, 15 of those leak out of your body every day. That's perfusing your tissues with fluid, bringing nutrients, okay? So that's at the proximal end of a capillary. And at the distal end, that fluid is resorbed, but not all that leaked out. Only 27 get resorbed. So that means that every day your body swells up by 3 liters. That's 1.5 of those jugs. So you can imagine what would happen to you in a period of a week, All right? If you didn't resorb that 3 liters every day, you just get bigger and bigger and bigger and then eventually probably explode or something. Okay, I'm not sure what would happen. All right, but yeah, something bad. So that extra 3 liters that's left in the tissue spaces gets absorbed by an auxiliary circulatory system that starts in the tissues, and that's what we call a lymphatic vessel. And in particular, where it starts is what we call a lymphatic capillary, because what's the kind of blood vessel that can absorb stuff from a tissue where exchange can take place? Is a capillary. So a lymphatic capillary is kind of similar to a regular capillary in your circulatory system because exchange can take place. But most of that exchange is going right into that lymphatic vessel. And that returns at 3 liters back to your circulatory system so that you don't dehydrate or so that you don't swell in a certain part of your body. Okay. Another function of the lymphatic system is that in your digestive tract, your circulatory system absorbs nutrients and amino acids and sugars, nucleic acids, things like that, but it does not absorb fat. So you need a special little auxiliary vascular system for absorbing fat, and that's a lymphatic vessel. It's a lymphatic vessel, but we call it a lacteal. So it's given a little bit different name. It absorbs fat from the gastrointestinal tract, and that fatty substance, when it combines with lymph, turns into a milky white fluid that we call chyle. And then the third thing, which we were kind of alluding to this whole time, is the body's self-defense system. Right, nodes filter lymph, the spleen filters blood. These contain lymphocytes that identify these pathogens and then figure out a way how to kill these pathogens before they do a lot of damage to you. But there's also lymphatic tissue all over your body, not necessarily contained in organs like the spleen and lymph nodes, but it's diffusely found everywhere in your body. We call this mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue, or MALT, and this tissue can be found, for instance, in your digestive tract and certain areas of your respiratory tract, all over your body, urinary tract, even reproductive tracts contain these centers that can fight infections should any of these organs ever become invaded. Okay. Well, let's look at, and as a matter of fact, I think you kind of know of a place in the digestive system that has lost its ability, at least in humans. It's lost its function for digestion, and the only function that remains is to fight infection. And it kind of looks like a little finger, like that. And that's the appendix. Okay, and that's filled with MALT, because in your large intestine, it's loaded with bacteria. Mostly in a healthy person, it's beneficial bacteria. Right? And nonetheless, it's the job of all the MALT that's in your digestive tract and the appendix to keep those bacteria, even though they're beneficial to you, inside your digestive tract. If they get out, then they're no longer going to be beneficial, right? If they start floating around in your circulatory system or attaching to your heart valves or things like that, that's not a good thing. So it's a job of the lymphatic system to make sure that they just stay inside the intestines. All right, lymphatic vessels carry lymph away from tissues. All right, back to the heart. So what kind of vessel, blood vessel, does that remind you of? Okay. What kind of vessel carries blood away from tissues? A vein, right? So lymphatic vessels, one way to model them in your mind is you should think of them as veins. And what kind of structure does a vein have that an artery doesn't have? That has valves. That's right. So lymphatic vessels have valves in them as well that allow lymph to only travel back to the heart, not back to the tissue spaces. But lymph always begins in a lymph capillary, simple squamous epithelium, and it has valves and flaps, and it kind of like gulps tissue fluid all the time. Okay, and then lymph capillaries join together to form vein-like lymph vessels, and lymph vessels contain valves to prevent retrograde flow. And the way that lymph finds its way back to the heart is the same way that blood in veins finds its way back to the heart. When a muscle contracts, that pressurizes that vessel, and the valves allow lymph only to squirt back to the heart. There is smooth muscle in the vessels, that when it contracts, it pressurizes lymph, and it can only squirt back to the heart, not back down to the tissues. Why can't it squirt back down into the tissues? Because there's valves in all these lymphatic organs. And of course, when we change pressure in our thorax, when we're breathing, when we take an inspiration that not only sucks air into our lungs, but it sucks blood in our veins up to our thoracic cavity, as well as lymph through lymphatic vessels back to our heart as well. All right, so this is kind of a nice little scheme for the lymphatic system. So here we have a nice artery bringing blood to a tissue. There's a capillary for exchange. 30 liters leak out every day, 27 get reabsorbed, but those extra 3 liters are picked up by these lymph capillaries, and it starts their way back to the circulatory system. And they're on the way back, okay? It can't go back to the tissue because of these valves that prevent retrograde flow. But you also see these other lymphatic tissues. As lymph goes back to the circulatory system, it has to be filtered by at least one node. Some pathways have more than one node, but at least one, so that pathogens are filtered out, and then it's dumped back into the circulatory system at a subclavian vein. Okay, so at the level of the subclavian vein, these lymphatic vessels empty that fluid back into the circulatory system so that we don't dehydrate. Okay, and the major vessels that empty into the subclavian vein right here is what we call a duct, a lymphatic duct. So a duct is a very, very large lymphatic vessel. All right, the right lymphatic duct drains lymph from the right upper limb and the vessels of the right half of the head, neck, and chest. That forms the right lymphatic duct, which empties into the right subclavian vein. So if we look at this next picture right here, and maybe you guys can see this, but you see this little notch right here in the person going all the way up? Mm-hmm. All right, and then the whole rest of the body right here is drained, okay, by the thoracic duct. So again, we see a lot of asymmetry in terms of the lymphatic system. The right lymphatic duct, which empties into the right subclavian right here, only drains the right side of the head and neck, right side of the thorax, and the right upper appendage, not the right abdomen and pelvic cavities, okay, because that's the job of the thoracic duct to do that. Okay, so what else do I see? Well, the thoracic duct, what helps form the thoracic duct is a big cistern right here that's collecting lymph from various trunks in the abdomen and pelvic cavities. This is what we call the cisterna chyli, and then the cisterna chyli empties into the thoracic duct, and then where does the thoracic duct go? Into the left subclavian, right up over here. All right, so the right lymphatic duct empties into the right subclavian, and the thoracic duct empties into the left subclavian. All right, so 3 liters pass through those things every day. You have some aggregations of lymph nodes located superficially on your body in a couple of locations. In the cervical region, these are what we call cervical nodes, and then in the axillary region, and then also in the inguinal region. These can be palpated very easily. So for instance, if there is an infection, maybe somebody can kind of get a guide to see how systemic that infection is. Because when there's an infection, these lymph nodes become activated and they start to grow and they get big and they swell up and they might even get a little painful. So for sure, if somebody presses on one, you can feel it. But somebody that's pressing can actually feel an enlarged area of lymph nodes in the cervical region, axillary region, and the inguinal region right here. Okay, and that means that those nodes are actually trying to fight that infection. Okay, so lymph organs. They contain lymphatic tissue composed of lymphocytes, macrophages, and other kinds of cells. Okay, so on that list of white blood cells that I wrote on the board, monocyte is one kind of cell that I wrote up. And a monocyte is really interesting because it's a shapeshifter. It can squish down, it changes shape. And so it's crawling around in your body and circulatory system all the time like an amoeba. And it's bumping into cells and looking for things that don't belong in your body. And when it finds something that doesn't have your body's markers on it, meaning it has a marker from some other kind of organism, It's going to engulf that particle. What do we call that process when a cell surrounds a particle and brings it into its own cell? It's a kind of eating. Phagocytosis, right? So a monocyte can phagocytize particles that don't belong in your body and then lyse them, break them apart. And what a macrophage is a monocyte that has left the circulatory system. So monocytes can leave. They can crawl out of a capillary because capillaries are kind of leaky, but it can slip right between the cells of a capillary and then crawl around in all kinds of different spaces in your body. They're patrolling all the alveoli in your lungs. Oh, we didn't get to the respiratory system yet. Okay, so they're just looking for things that don't belong in your body. So a macrophage was once a monocyte that has left the circulatory system. Lymphocytes originate in red bone marrow, just like red blood cells, and are carried by the blood to lymphatic organs. And microorganisms, or any kind of invading substance, right, can stimulate lymphocyte cell division. All right, so when they bump into a bacteria, they're going to understand something particular about that bacteria, and then these lymphocytes are going to divide, and all of the daughter cells know how to recognize that bacteria. And each one of those new lymphocytes then can help fight that infection. And so that happens in what we call a germinal center. So germination is just another word for like growing. So this is a tissue that is proliferating. It's growing by mitosis, but it's sharing how to identify each of those pathogens. All right, so we have germinal centers in lymph nodes and tonsils, and also in the appendix. And when these germinal centers are activated, learning how to fight that particular pathogen, we call that immune system activation. So immune system activation is when a lymph node gets swollen and is producing a lot of lymphocytes. Okay. So each one of these lymph nodes right here can help fight infection. So here is a nice diagram of a lymph node. And you can see there are lymph vessels that are bringing lymph to the node, and then there are some vessels that take lymph away. The vessels that bring lymph to this node are called afferent vessels. Lymph vessels that carry lymph away are called efferent. Afferent and efferent, just like how you learn for signals entering or leaving the brain. And the lymph node has a capsule around it. And here are the germinal centers, here, here, and over here. And lymph is just flowing through these various centers, and they bump into lymphocytes and macrophages, and that's how your body fights infections. Okay, the tonsils fight infection. They contain malt, and you have three kinds of tonsils. Maybe we won't see them until we get to the lymphatic system, until the respiratory system. But in lab, I think you had to know where these are. The palatine tonsil is in the posterior oral cavity. Those you can see if somebody sticks their tongue out at you, right, if they still have them. The pharyngeal tonsils are a little bit harder to see. Sometimes these are called adenoids. And the lingual tonsils are at the posterior base of the tongue. Those are hard to see. These can become chronically infected in some individuals. And if they are chronically infected, then a person never hardly ever gets over a sore throat. So they'll have a cold like 12 months out of the year, and maybe once a month it will flare up really bad to where they have to miss work and be placed on antibiotics and things like that. So that's very painful and very disruptive to that person's life. So one of the ways that we treat that is to remove the tonsils that are chronically infected. And what do we call that? That's a tonsillectomy, right? Okay. If it's a youngster, right, a pre-pubertal person, that's a very easy kind of procedure to undergo. They're probably going to be up running around in a day or two, probably eating ice cream that very same day. But if it's an adult, it's a very difficult kind of surgery to go through, and you'll probably be out of work for like 2 weeks recovering from that surgery. All right, so even if you get a gallbladder removed today, you're probably only going to miss maybe 2 or 3 days of work, and then you're going to be back at work. But a tonsillectomy, really disrupts your throat. It's hard to breathe. It's hard to eat. Because, for instance, the palatine tonsils probably are about as big as the tip of your little finger, and they're implanted into your posterior pharynx. And when you lose that much tissue bilaterally, you can imagine what kind of soreness that would be in your throat. Because you probably had a little paper cut at one time on a finger, and how sore that would get. Well, just multiply that, you know, by a couple thousand times. That would be, for instance, a surgical site for those tonsils. So it's not something that you can do without planning, but it's still very worthwhile to do because it will change somebody's life from being really sick with a sore throat once a month. After the tonsillectomy, it's probably common where people don't get sick for probably a year, maybe two. And so it's really kind of a life-changing surgery. So it's highly recommended, but okay, it's not necessarily easy to get through. Okay, the lymph nodes, I think we talked about already. We saw where they are. And it filters lymph. It contains both lymphocytes and macrophages to fight infection. And the spleen is located in the left upper abdominal cavity. It doesn't filter lymph, but it filters blood. So what the heck is in blood? Well, these erythrocytes right here don't have a nucleus. An erythrocyte just kind of looks like that with a little kind of dimple in the middle. It's loaded with a chemical compound for transporting blood, which is called hemoglobin. It's so packed full of hemoglobin, there's no room for organelles, there's no room for a nucleus inside this particular cell. Its job is just to carry oxygen. So if there's damage to this red blood cell, since there's no nucleus, it can't respond to any kind of challenge. It can't build new proteins to deal with some kind of insult. Right, so as soon as it becomes a red cell, it's programmed to die. It only has a very short lifespan. And a red blood cell will live for only about 120 days. And then it's going to die. And it's the job of the spleen to get rid of old and damaged red blood cells because they die so frequently. And as a matter of fact, does anybody know how many red blood cells die in your body every second? Okay, so you might wonder, well, the job of the spleen is not too tough. I mean, how many cells could die? Red blood cells. Well, okay, they only live for 120 days. Between 2 and 3 million red blood cells die every second in your body. So that's a lot. Okay, so the spleen is very busy clearing all those red blood cells. Very active organ. And what's that condition that's called that develops when somebody's running low on red blood cells? What is that called? That's anemia. Yeah, that's anemia. So if you lose between 2 and 3 million red blood cells every second, how many does your body have to make so that you don't become anemic? It's got to be the exact same number. Okay, the exact same number. All right, so between 2 and 3 million every second your body has to make. Otherwise, you become anemic. So what's the name of the tissue that makes red blood cells? Okay. It's the same place where leukocytes are made. That's in red bone marrow. So red bone marrow makes erythrocytes. And again, that's a hugely active area. If you're losing millions of red blood cells every second, you have to be producing that. So it's actually a pretty amazing factory that we live in. It's producing all these things all the time. Okay, the spleen also contains red blood cells. For instance, if you experience an acute hemorrhage, it can release red blood cells into the circulatory system to make up to some degree for those millions of red blood cells that you lose unexpectedly. And the spleen also functions in the immune system because it filters blood of pathogens, and it can learn to recognize pathogens and develop a strategy to kill them. The unfortunate thing about the spleen is that it doesn't contain much in the way of connective tissue. Let's see where the spleen is. Okay, so here's the spleen right here. There's the thymus gland. Okay. And So when we look at the spleen, it only has a very thin capsule that has connective tissue, but most of the tissue, either the white pulp or the red pulp, is highly vascular. It's mostly blood vessels. So when it's traumatized, it has a tendency to rip apart. Right? Since it doesn't have any bones in there, it doesn't have collagen holding it together, and because it's so highly vascular, when it does rip, guess what happens? It hemorrhages profusely. And since it doesn't have connective tissue, like for instance, if you lacerate your integument, right, or somebody does surgery on you and cuts your integument, what's an easy way to help that integument heal? Just kind of suture it back together, because your dermis is dense, irregular connective tissue, a lot of collagen. You can suture that back together. It holds the suture, but the spleen doesn't. If we were to place a suture in the spleen, guess what would happen? It would just rip some more, which means then it's going to bleed more. And then you put another suture in, it's just going to start bleeding even more. So when the spleen is traumatized, it has to be ablated. It has to be just taken out of a person. Otherwise, they're going to bleed to death. And then, of course, what happens is that person will be at a little bit of a deficit in terms of their immune response and the cleansing of their blood, and other parts of their body have a tendency to take over, but it still will be depressed. So somebody that's missing the spleen will always be slightly immunocompromised, unfortunately. Okay, the thymus gland, located in the superior mediastinum, that functions as a place for maturation of what we call T lymphocytes. Okay. B lymphocytes are mostly found in lymph nodes, but T lymphocytes in the thymus. And let me just give you a little overview of these different kinds of lymphocytes. Okay, so a lymphocyte is what kind of cell? It's a white blood cell. All right, and it divides and produces two different kinds. A B lymphocyte. And a second kind is a T lymphocyte. Okay. And a T lymphocyte, once it learns how to identify a pathogen, all right, the T lymphocyte can bump into a pathogen, and then it's going to kill the pathogen. It's going to like explode. It's going to lyse that pathogen, but it has to bind to certain membrane receptors on that pathogen. So we call this a contact killer. It's a contact killer cell. It's got to bump into somebody. All right. The B lymphocyte, on the other hand, doesn't have to bump into a bacteria or a virus to kill them, but it's going to produce chemical compounds that will do that job for them. Does anybody know what those chemical compounds are called?
Antibodies.
For instance, antibodies. That's right. So a B lymphocyte produces antibodies. So instead of contact killer, we call this antibody mediated immunity. Okay, and the contact killer is what we call cell-mediated immunity. And so a B lymphocyte will start to produce antibodies, but the first time you have an infection, it might take maybe 2 weeks for these B lymphocytes to produce enough antibodies to fight and kill that infection that you have in your person. So, for instance, when you get the flu or a cold or something, about how long does it take you to get fully recovered from that? It's about 2 weeks, all right? Maybe a week to 2 weeks. That's because these B lymphocytes have to learn and produce enough antibodies to fight that particular infection. Okay? And the same thing for the T lymphocytes. T lymphocytes mature in a specific organ in your body. And that's why it was called a T lymphocyte. What organ in your body is a place where T lymphocytes go to mature to learn how to fight infections? That would be the thymus gland. Okay, but lymph nodes contain these B lymphocytes. So this is kind of easy for me to remember, right? Because I see a lot of T's in contact. Same thing for thymus gland, for the T cells, right? An antibody, I see a B here, an antibody, that's the B cell. And maybe they were kind of named that way. Okay, so two different modes of fighting infection. Okay. So there was one last slide I did want to show you a little bit. This one right here. Okay, so here are the tonsils we see up over here in the oral cavity. Here's the thymus gland. Here's the spleen. Okay, then the appendix down here and a bunch of nodes along the digestive tract. And again, these nodes just make sure that bacteria that are in the intestines stay in the intestines, don't have access to your body. What was another one? Oh, we don't see lymph nodes, but we saw pictures of lymph nodes in various places before. Okay. Well, let's just go back and look at, oh, let's see, do I have a picture right here? No. Okay. I was going to show you a lacteal, but when we get to the digestive system, we'll see a lacteal. All right, so think of all the functions of the lymphatic system, and let's just say somebody has a breast tumor right here, and that breast tumor involved a couple axillary nodes. So what do we do when we remove that breast tumor? What do we do with these axillary nodes? Yeah, they have to be removed as well, right? And probably a few more just to make sure that you don't miss any cancer. They're sent to pathology, and then they look to see how far the cancer has progressed, and hopefully they've taken out all the nodes that have cancerous tissue and some nodes that don't have cancerous tissue, which is good, right? Because then they haven't missed it. All right, but now what happens to that region of the body? What else is this lymphatic system doing besides fighting infection? What else is it? Look at the functions of the lymphatic system. What else are these lymphatic vessels doing? Okay, they're returning tissue fluid that has leaked out of capillaries in this region of the body back to the circulatory system. But now if you've taken those lymphatic vessels out, what happens to this area of the body? Since, well, it's going to swell. What do we call that swelling? That's edema. Right, so that's one of the side effects of any of these kinds of surgeries. That region of the body is going to swell up until maybe some collateral circulation can be developed, right, to take over, and maybe it won't ever be redeveloped. You just don't ever really know, depending on the extent of that surgery. Okay, so anytime you mess with these lymphatic vessels, you're messing with what, the return of fluids back to the circulatory system, as well as being able to fight infection. All right, so that's it for lymphatic system. So that means we're going to start the next chapter. So let's see what the next chapter is. Okay, next chapter, respiratory system. Chapter 21. Okay, so let's talk about the functions of the respiratory system. It's important for ventilation, that means moving air in and out of our lungs. That's one real important function. But why is it that we move air in and out of our lungs? Because there's something in air that we want inside our bodies, which is oxygen, and then there's another gas that our body produces that we want out. We want to excrete it, and that is CO2. Right, so one of the functions of the respiratory system is to just move air in and out of the lungs. You might call that ventilation. Right, so don't just say respiration, because respiration could have some chemical connotations to it, like certain kinds of metabolism we call respiration. All right, and then in the lungs, gas exchange has to happen. So oxygen leaves the air, enters our blood. CO2 leaves the blood, goes into the air, and then we exhale that out. Transport of these gases in the circulatory system is another important function of the respiratory system. and then gas exchange between the blood and the tissues outside the lungs in the systemic circulation. That's an important function of the respiratory system. And in terms of anatomy, the respiratory system can be broken down into two main regions, the upper respiratory tract and the lower respiratory tract. So let's see where these things are. So here we see a nice kind of coronal section. This guy's got his head turned a little bit, but we can see the nasal cavity right here. And going back down to the throat, and the name for the throat is the pharynx. So when somebody has a sore throat, what do they really have? They have a pharyngitis, all right, that's a sore throat right over here. And then there are two passageways. Things can move when they're in your pharynx. They can move through the esophagus going down to the stomach, which I don't see on this diagram, or they can move from your pharynx into the larynx right here. And what happens when you have an inflammation of the larynx? What do we call that?
Laryngitis.
Laryngitis, as opposed to pharyngitis. Now, when you get a pharyngitis, do you lose your voice?
No.
Not necessarily. It's painful to swallow, but what condition do you have when you lose your voice? Laryngitis, because here is the larynx. When that gets inflamed, there are some ligaments that go across the larynx that we call vocal folds, and those become inflamed and get stiff or whatever, and your voice is going to change pitch, and maybe you won't be able to speak at all as a result of that. So this right here is the line of demarcation between the upper respiratory tract, which includes the nasal cavity, and I suppose even the oral cavity and the pharynx, and the lower respiratory tract, which begins here at the larynx, proceeds further on into the trachea. The trachea is going to bifurcate into bronchi, and then all the structures inside the lungs are part of the lower respiratory tract. Okay, so what are some things of, I'm not going to ask you to know the cartilages of the nose, but we see primarily the upper respiratory tract here. Okay, we see the hard palate, and you should know that these are made up of what, the maxilla and the palatine bones, and then we have the soft palate over here. There are no bones in that, but there are muscles so that when you swallow, that occludes this passageway so food doesn't end up in your nasal cavity. That's important. You see the three nasal conchae. What are the functions of these nasal conchae again? It's filled with mucous membrane, so it air conditions the air. If the air is too hot, it cools it down a little bit so you don't burn your lungs, as long as you're not in a burning building or something. If it's air is cold, these heat the air up so you don't freeze your lungs. Or if you live in LA, right, where the conditions are kind of like a desert, this moisturizes the air so that you don't dehydrate your lungs out in your body. Okay, so it just air conditions the air. It also absorbs particulate matter, prevents particulate matter from entering the lungs. And the pharynx, or the throat, is actually broken down into three main areas. The one posterior to the tongue right here is what we call the oropharynx, because here is the oral cavity. Above the oral cavity, what's above the oral cavity?
Nasal
cavity. So that part of the throat is called the nasopharynx. And then the part that's down over here, the part of the pharynx that's down here by the larynx, is what we call the laryngopharynx. Okay, so these are the three parts of the pharynx. And here's that little thing hanging off the soft palate, the uvula. Now, do I see any tonsils anywhere? Here's the pharyngeal tonsil. Here's the lingual tonsil. But I guess I don't see any palatines because they're lateral. You got them someplace here? I don't see it. Oh, here. Okay. Oh, there you go. That's it. Okay, palatine tonsil. Then here's the uvula right here. Okay, so those are the three tonsils, lymphoid tissue. Each of them can be chronically infected. Most commonly, it's the palatine tonsil that does. Okay, so when you breathe air in, let's see, we also have the orifice for the eustachian tube right here that connects up to your middle ear. Right, so when you have a pharyngitis, it's possible to get otitis media, infection of the middle ear compartment. if not treated properly. And so when you're breathing, air comes down and doesn't go into your stomach, but it goes into the trachea via the larynx right here. Now, do these things look like blue to you? Yeah, blue. These are cartilages. All right, so, and you can see some, well, the intervertebral discs are kind of cartilage, fibrocartilage. So cartilage has a blue appearance on this diagram. And this the opening to the larynx is what we call the glottis. And so you might be wondering, well, why is it that when we swallow something, it almost always goes into the stomach via the esophagus, but when we breathe, it goes into the airway, this lower airway right here, and that's the job of the epiglottis to do that. It's a trapdoor. All right, so right now it's pointed superiorly, but when you swallow something, it gets pulled over the glottis, right? It flops down, and it prevents the entry of food, usually into the trachea. And that's actually a very good thing, because the trachea right here has its own cartilage. It has C-shaped cartilages, and it gives the trachea a certain kind of structure, namely that the trachea is held open all the time. It's always open. So if you were to take a penny or something and hold it over the larynx and let go, what would happen to that penny? It would fall right into the trachea, and then it could block that airway, for instance. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, that's really a bad thing, because you're going to feel like you're going to die, and as a matter of fact, you probably could if you can't start breathing. So what is the procedure that maybe some of you here are educated to perform on somebody with a blocked airway?
Heimlich maneuver.
A Heimlich maneuver. That's right. Okay, that's a maneuver that some you would perform on somebody that's choking because they swallowed something and it didn't go into the esophagus. It just got over here into the larynx, right, and then just fell right in because the trachea is held open all the time, right, because of these C-shaped cartilages right here. Now, I know a lot of you are CPR certified and you know the answer to this, so don't yell it out. Well, if you know, just tell me. Okay, there's a day of the week that most people choke. What day is that? What day of the week do most people choke? You're right, it's Friday. What did you say, Saturday?
Monday.
Monday, yeah, I'm choking. Yeah, so it's good not to have a test on Monday. Yeah, furthermore, there is a time on Friday when most people choke.
Nice.
So what time is that? Is it like in the morning or afternoon?
It could be in the morning.
But most commonly, okay, and you guys should kind of pay attention to this, is around 4:30 to around 6 o'clock in the evening. Okay, and the reason why that is because that's when a lot of people that are working all week long, right, comrades, they go to happy hour, right? And so they share a pitcher of beer or some drinks, right? So it's usually alcohol-related. People are horsing around a little bit. But what else are you doing besides drinking? If you were just drinking, it would probably be okay, but you're eating like popcorn or popcorn shrimp or nachos or something, and you're sitting around the table, and then just as you're about, you're chewing a nacho or something, you're about ready to swallow, somebody tells a joke about their anatomy instructor, and what happens? You go, you take a gasp like that with food in your mouth, and where does the food go? Instead of in the esophagus, it goes past the epiglottis right into the trachea, okay? So it's usually associated, like I said, with adult beverage and horsing around. But Saturday night is probably the second most common time for that to happen when people are having a really good time. And then you got to just be aware of this, and then you have to perform the Heimlich maneuver. But don't ever perform a Heimlich unless you do what first? Because the Heimlich maneuver is kind of a radical procedure. If I did that to you in the elevator or something, I would be sued, right? So you always have to ask somebody first. Right? Are you choking? And if they're choking, what is their response going to be? Is it going to be nothing, right? Because they're thinking they're going to die. But there is something that you should know, and that is if you are choking because you're horsing around too much, like during a test or whatever, what is the universal symbol for choking? And it's a request for help. It's two hands, yeah, around the throat like that. So if you ever see somebody doing that, then of course you should try to aid them. Even if nobody knows CPR, you should try to do something to help clear their airway, even if you're not educated in the Heimlich maneuver. Yeah?
You mentioned before about the whole breathing part, like if someone is breathing and how it can get free and then it gets stuck in the trachea.
Yeah.
Couldn't that sometimes also happen, like like if you're chewing all of a sudden and the next thing you know you feel like you might sneeze and then you accidentally like...
Oh, if a sneeze interrupts your swallowing at the wrong possible moment? I suppose that could happen. Did that happen to you?
Twice?
Okay. You know, but of course, little kids, because the first part of swallowing, the first part, when we get to the digestive system next time, the first part of swallowing is a voluntary action. The last two-thirds of swallowing is involuntary. But in order to initiate it, that's a voluntary action. And if you get confused, there's no automatic system to prevent you from breathing and swallowing at the same time. And that's when you get into trouble. There was a question up over here someplace. Yeah. Yeah, there is a good Samaritan law, but of course you can be sued. You know, I could get sued for giving this lecture. So in the United States, you can get sued for anything, but you do have protections in court as long as you perform whatever you're doing at the level of your expertise, right? So if you're a physician, you are expected to have more expertise, right? But if you don't know CPR at all, then you're going to be held to a much lesser standard. So there's probably almost no way it would stand up in court. But if you're CPR certified, right, so you should know how to do these procedures, and you do something terrible, for instance, on somebody. Maybe you decide, well, I'm going to perform a tracheotomy on somebody because their airway is closed. Well, you don't have that expertise to do that, and you're educated enough probably to know you shouldn't probably do something like that. Okay, you could get in trouble. So there are good Samaritan laws, but you have to always behave at your level of expertise. You can't go beyond, and if you do something that doesn't reach that level of expertise, yeah, you could be sued for that. All right, so all depends on how a jury might perceive that circumstance. All right, so what's this job of the epiglottis? What does it do?
Keeps the food out.
It keeps the food out of your airway. So don't forget, the larynx is the beginning of the lower airway. The larynx has a number of different cartilages that you should be aware of. Let's see, I don't know if there's anything else. I think that was an exam figure for you. Okay. Here are the cartilages of the larynx. Okay, thyroid cartilage, that's the prominent cartilage in your neck. Below that is the cricoid cartilage. The cricoid cartilage wraps around all the way posterior, but the thyroid cartilage does not. Then you have a couple other smaller cartilages like the corniculate cartilage, a really, really tiny one that sits on top of the arytenoids. Right, the arytenoids help control the tension on the vocal cords, which is what we use to control the pitch of our voice. So here we have the glottis, the epiglottis, thyroid cartilage, cricoid cartilage, the arytenoid and corniculate cartilage, and I think that's all the cartilages that you have to know for the larynx. And of course inside you have the vocal folds. And then that takes us to the trachea. You can see the C-shaped cartilages. You don't have to know the names of any of these. As a matter of fact, I don't think I ever learned any names of those. But on the posterior aspect of the trachea, okay, so here's anterior, here's posterior, here's trachea. On the posterior aspect of the trachea, we say it's a C-shaped ring, right? It's not circular, it doesn't go all the way around, because on the posterior side, this has to give way sometimes when you swallow a bolus of food. And so if the cartilage was continuous even on the posterior side of the trachea, that could block a bolus of food from entering the stomach. And so there is just a muscle over here that we call the trachealis on the posterior side. And then immediately posterior to the trachea, we find the esophagus, right? So on your cats, it's easy to find the trachea. Just put a nice blunt probe right underneath the trachea, and then you should be able to separate the esophagus out very easily. Okay. The epithelium that lines the trachea is kind of special because it's a pseudo-stratified ciliated columnar epithelium. All right, so yeah, it's a mouthful, but you should know what the function of that is. It is ciliated. What's the function of cilia? For motility, for movement. And it's not that these cells move around, but these cells also have, or this epithelium has goblet cells that secrete mucus onto this apical surface, and the cilia move that mucus one way or the other. The job of the mucus is to trap dust particles so that dust doesn't enter our lungs. So which way do you think the cilia are sweeping? Down or up? It's sweeping up, that's right. So the mucus and dust is being swept up into our oral cavity, And then we get rid of it from our body by just swallowing it down. Okay? Unless you're what? Baseball player. That's right. Unless you're a baseball player, then you spit all the time. Okay. Okay, so you should know something about that membrane right there. Okay, the trachea, let's see, bifurcates into bronchi. Okay, and we're going to stop pretty soon. All right, so here's the trachea. It bifurcates into the main bronchus, either the right or left. And this is the left lung over here. Notice that the left lung is not as big as the right lung. That seems like a waste of lung. Why is that? There's a good reason. Why is that? Because your heart is in this cavity right here, right? So the left lung is smaller. It doesn't have as many lobes. And as a matter of fact, the entrance, the left main bronchus is smaller because the left lung is smaller than the right lung. And this angle is a little bit more acute. So when things fall into trachea, if it falls all the way down into a bronchus, there's one that it has a tendency to fall into more than the other. It falls into the right because it's bigger and it's a straighter shot, okay, compared to the left bronchus over here. Okay, so there's a main bronchus and then it bifurcates. So here you can see a secondary bronchus, and then a secondary bronchus is going to bifurcate again to get into a tertiary bronchus, and then smaller and smaller and smaller until it gets to the smallest places of the lungs. Okay, so okay, all right, so we're going to start here in lungs next time. Okay, so remind me to start with lungs. And now's a good time to do all your homework, all the pre-reading assignments for the rest of the chapter. Because when is the final? It's not next week, but it's like the week right after. So it's coming very soon. Very, very soon. All right, let me turn my microphone off.